In Sapporo, I met an Ainu gardener, Ota Hideki. The Ainu are Japan's oldest indigenous group and even lower on our social ladder than the Koreans. Maybe that is why he took pity on me, another pariah cast out by the tribe of Yamato. Maybe it was because he had no one to pass his skills or knowledge along to. His own son had never returned from Manchuria. Ota-san worked at the Akakaze, a former luxury hotel that now served as a repatriation center for Japanese settlers from China. At first, the administration complained that they had no more funds to hire another gardener. Ota-san paid me out of his own pocket. He was my teacher and my only friend, and when he died, I considered following him. But coward that I was, I could not bring myself to do it. Instead, I simply continued to exist, working silently in the earth as the Akakaze went from a repatriation center to a luxury hotel, and Japan went from conquered rubble to economic superpower. I was still working at the Akakaze when I heard of the first domestic outbreak. I was trimming the Western-style hedges near the restaurant when I overheard several of the guests discussing the Nagumo murders. According to their conversation, a man had slain his wife, then set upon the corpse like some kind of wild dog. This was the first time I had heard the term African rabies. I tried to ignore it, tried to get on with my work. But the next day there were more conversations, more hushed voices across the lawn and beside the pool. Nagumo was old news compared to the much more serious outbreak at Sumitomo Hospital in Osaka. And the next day there was Nagoya, then Sendai, then Kyoto. I tried to push their conversations from my mind. I had come to Hokkaido to escape from the world, to live out my days in shame and ignominy. The voice that finally convinced me of danger came from the hotel's manager, a stiff, no-nonsense salaryman with a very formal manner of speech. After the outbreak in Hirosaki, he held a staff meeting to try and debunk, once and for all, these wild rumors about dead bodies coming back to life. I had only his voice to rely on, and you can tell everything about a person by what happens when he opens his mouth. Mr. Sugawara was pronouncing his words far too carefully, particularly his hard, sharp consonants. He was overcompensating for a previously conquered speech impediment, a condition that only threatened to rise in the presence of great, uncontrollable anxiety. I had listened to this verbal defense mechanism before, from the seemingly unflappable Sugawara-san, first during the 95 quake, and again in 98 when North Korea had sent a long-range, nuclear-capable test missile streaking over our homeland. Sugawara-san's articulation had been almost imperceptible then. Now it shrieked louder than the air raid sirens of my youth.